You've just spent quite a bit of time in Africa, have you not? And what were you working on there?
For the past 2 years, I've been working as a climate change advisor with the U.S. Agency for International Development. And my focus area has been to integrate climate change and food security issues. And as part of the tasks, and our efforts have been to engage policymakers as well as farmers and ranchers to incorporate the impacts of climate change in their decision-making process, both at the national level and at the farm level.
Here in the United States, there's a relationship between government and agriculture. Do you find that in all nations or the nations that you've looked at?
Yes. I mean, agriculture forms one of the key bases for economic growth in many countries and for the security of their citizens, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. There are a lot of farmers, there's a lot of poverty, and a lot of farmers actually consume a great majority portion of what they grow. So it's basically sustenance farming. And to grow enough produce that they can be taken care of as well as earn a livelihood out of it is sometimes can be challenging. Countries have actually put in place plans to bolster agricultural-led economic growth. Our efforts have been to make sure that the impacts of climate change are incorporated in those plans at the national level, because addressing these issues require a lot of interministerial, you know, engagement. And so it's a multi-sector solution. It's not a single sector. You can't just focus on agriculture. You got to look at water issues. You got to look at energy issues. You got to look at transportation. And so there are many different sectors that need to come together to effect change.
Are we doing that here in the United States?
Yes, I think we are, and a lot more can be done. And, you know, our U.S. Department of Agriculture is very proactive in addressing these issues.
In Africa, did you focus in your work in one particular country or a particular region?
Our mandate is to work across sub-Saharan Africa. But during my tenure at USAID, I primarily focused on policy issues in West Africa. I also worked with folks in Southern Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, in Zambia. And in Zambia, we came up with this specific, more focused study to explore relationship between farm-level activity and landscape-level processes and policy decisions, because these farmers operate within that landscape and what happens outside of their farm impacts them. And what they do within their farm and their reliance on the larger environment has an impact on the environment as well. It's very important to understand what those relationships are. Where are the decision points? And what do we know about these relationships? Are there things that we really need to understand better before we can develop effective policies? And so that work is being done, again, in partnership with the USAID mission in Zambia and other colleagues within the Washington, D.C. office of USAID to help promote in eastern province of the Zambia, to help better understand how people can adopt, you know, fertilizer trees, which increase the fertility of the soil and the quality of the soil, and hence provides greater output from that farm, and how adoption of various fertilizer trees feeds into the interaction of those farmers with the larger landscape.
Could you define fertilizer trees for us and explain exactly how it is they work? I heard you say this before, and there's some kind of a cyclical benefit to them.
Right. The term fertilizer trees is often used to describe a process of agroforestry. It's a practice.
Is it any one specific species of trees, or does any tree accomplish the same thing?
There are certain kinds of trees that are suitable for this and are used in various parts of the world. In Africa, the soils are old and depleted of carbon, so the quality of the soil is poor. And sometimes that, you know, that has a major impact on the productivity of those fields. And so all their efforts of putting in fertilizer to increase production doesn't yield the expected benefits because the quality of the soil is poor. So one of the options that people can do, the farmers, is to plant actual trees like Phytophthora or Gliricidia. These are different kinds of trees that what they do is they are able to capture atmospheric nitrogen and they convert it into a nitrogen form in the soil that other plants can benefit from. So it occurs through an association of processes that happen within the roots of the plants. And for example, you know, soybean does that, right? And so by incorporating these trees that do that function, you're putting in fertilizer into the soil. But because these trees also fix carbon, they are putting carbon into the soil.
You talk about organic carbon. I talk about compost. Does the tree somehow put organic matter, compost, into the soil?
Yes. So as, for example, the leaf litter fall, you know, that can get incorporated into the soil. The nitrogen contained in these leaves can also fertilize the soil. The roots that are growing below ground, you know, some of the roots die off and they get incorporated into the soil. So the input of actually putting in more carbon in the soil that is retained there is a very, very important process and a very good way to improve the quality of soil for increasing production.
Have local farmers been seeing increased production already?
There have been success stories. And for example, as my USAID colleagues have pointed out, in the past, this lady from Malawi who was a widow and had to take care of her kids, her farm was very infertile and the soil was very poor. And so she was able to grow certain trees that can, you know, fertilizer trees that improve the soil quality. And because of the improved soil quality, she started getting greater production from the farm. And once she had greater production from the farm, she was able to sell a bit of that produce and invest that in livestock. And once she had that livestock, she was able to feed them with the fodder from these trees and was able to harvest the manure and fertilize the farm. So because of using this whole life cycle, you know, approach, an integrated approach of farm management, was done by a woman farmer in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, that's just amazing. And as a result, you know, her production jumped from 3 bags from her field to 49 bags from her field. I mean, I think that's an amazing growth. Similarly, we've seen in the country next doors, Zambia, and during my visits there, I had an opportunity to talk to a woman, you know, a single woman farmer taking care of a lot of orphaned kids as well. So with a lot of responsibilities, but she had adopted the agroforestry, approach, practices, and she's now become a lead farmer. And so she teaches other farmers how to adopt and practice these technologies. And as a result of increased production, she has now actually bought a house or built a house by a roadside. I mean, those are major achievements. And she can see her bank balance grow. And so when I was there, she actually showed me a deposit receipt from her bank balance and saying how adopting certain approaches have directly translated into her well-being. And I think this is where science has its biggest impact.
Were these people assisted by any kind of change in policy on a larger scale that maybe provided them with startup money to do this?
Well, that's an excellent question. And so, as I said, there are multiple choke points for adoption of some of this technology. Clearly, having the right policy is a big, big deal. If you don't have the right policy, then it can really hamstring some of the adoption of some of these approaches. But at the same time, you also need a network of people or extension workers to help provide the technical information to do that. you also need market connections so that if you have increased production, there is some way of getting that produce out to the market. So it's a whole systems approach that we have to think about. I'll give you an example on policy. In certain countries, the trees, even if it grew on your farm, you couldn't own them. It belonged to the government. So nobody wanted to invest in a resource that they couldn't utilize it. So there was a policy change on saying that, yes, you can harvest and use the trees that are on your farm. And that led to an adoption of that, you know, approach. Similarly, there are land tenure issues. So if somebody's renting, the title of the land is, you know, with somebody else. And if they are renting the land for a few years, they're not too interested in investing in something that pays off over the long term. And I want to say it very clearly that, you know, just one technology, agroforestry is an example. It doesn't mean that it's a silver bullet and would work everywhere. But where it has potential, I think all other factors need to be looked at to ensure that there is greater adoption of these technologies.
What are the effects of climate change on agriculture? And some, I think some of the what you talk about in Africa is almost like on a microeconomic scale. But is that a microcosm of the bigger picture?
Yes, the impact of climate change is not going to be uniform across the globe. Some places are going to get much drier. At other places, they're going to get much better. But one thing is certain, that the temperatures are increasing. So there's going to be greater variability in the precipitation pattern. So you could get a lot of rain at one time. So too much rain at the wrong time is not good for agriculture either. But there will be places where there's not going to be much of a change, right? But the changes in the availability of water and duration, quantity, and quality of water that's coming down, as well as the change in temperature, has an impact on the plants. For example, plants need some specific temperature, optimum range, in which to perform well, right? With increasing temperatures, that can change. So the phenological requirements of the plants are going to be upset. And stressed out plants are more susceptible to pests and diseases. You know, of course, we're trying to generate, you know, seeds for plants that are drought tolerant, you know, or heat tolerant, precisely because there's going to be greater fluctuation and we need to ensure that the plants are able to cope. The other aspect of it is it's going to take more and more energy to store. You know, when you have after harvest, if you want to store the grains and produce, temperature is going to have a big impact on its quality and shelf life. And so the climate change impact actually impacts agriculture sector right from the farm to fork.
And let's talk about population. Population seems to be a touchy subject because as a policy, it doesn't really work to try to reduce population, does it?
That's the big elephant in the room or the gorilla in the room, right? Unless and until we are able to control the rapid increase in our population, global population, it'll be extremely difficult for us to address other issues. The population growth, when we look at globally, yes, we are growing at a very rapid rate, but there are stark differences in regions. Obviously, India and China are growing quite rapidly. There are other, their population increases through either immigration and or growth. That's inevitable, and it's going to happen in Africa as well. Such increase in population, for example, we're going to be 9 billion people by 2050, is going to present huge challenges in terms of our energy consumption, in terms of land for these to house people and work. So the energy consumption is going to go up, the water consumption is going to go up, and there's going to be less land for food. And without controlling the population or changing the trajectory of the population growth, it's going to be extremely hard for us to address some of these issues. How do we go about doing globally is a challenge. I don't have an answer to that yet.
When I was born, there were fewer than 3 billion people on this planet. And so in my lifetime, it's very likely that it'll triple.
Right. And that is what exponential growth does. You know, we have 2050 as a mark, and we say 9 billion. We are 7 billion, a little over 7 billion now. And so it's another 30 years, we would be 9 billion. But we are not going to stop there. I mean, 2050 is just a mark to tell us that that's a big, you know, could be a big tipping point. But it is going to increase unless until there are drastic steps taken to reduce such a rapid growth. Inevitably, what's probably going to happen is with such great increase in population, there's going to be greater demand for resources, and that could lead to both land, air, and water. And as a result, it's going to lead to a lot more conflicts. And we're seeing that being played out around the globe today when people do not have access to enough resources for survival.
P.V. Sundareshwar, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to South Dakota Public Radio.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I think this is a great service if we can get the message out to people and our decision makers and policymakers of what we need to do to address climate change. I think that would be a very good step forward.